This is Tommy Thompson, recorded at Ardrossan, Ayrshire, on the 1st of October 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Tommy Thompson, Disc 3 of 3.
Are you happy to resume, Tommy?
Sure.
How did Ice Cold Katie get her name?
It was Bernard who
gave... Stonehouse?
Yes, who gave her the name. I think it was... It was in a film, I'm not sure, but he
said... It was the ambulance in Ice Cold in Alex.
Ambulance?
The ambulance in Ice Cold in Alex.
Is that it?
Was called Ice Cold Katie.
It was on TV just the other day?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was the ambulance was called Ice Cold Katie. Yeah.
62 years later, Tommy, you learned something.
Oh, every day. Yeah.
I appreciate her lifespan was quite short in the Antarctic, but you reckon she was a good plane?
I do.
What was good about her?
It was a big... We didn't give her a full life, which was a great shame. But the little I used her with, she was absolutely great. Dave Jones, the engineer, had to do a bit of work on her, especially on the skis, because Dave knew nothing about skis and I had never flown on skis. But we worked out that we ought to have, when we're landing down on the ice, that we ought to have the tip a little bit raised up. So we put a bit of bungee on the tip of each ski, so that when we came down, it landed like that, not like that.
So the toes did not dig in.
Yeah. And really, I was, what little I did, I was very, very happy with it indeed. Mm. Yeah.
There was a problem with the tail wheel, wasn't there?
Didn't do enough to find one. To be honest, yeah.
Did the tail wheel not tend to get clogged up with snow?
No, because we didn't do enough, really. We did very little. Before the big long trip south, we did practically nothing at all because the ice wasn't right.
Yeah.
Was she blown around a bit on horizontal sideways? Was she susceptible to side winds?
No. No. But, and we found the little we used her, we could see that occasionally she was taking updrafts, most steadily indeed. You would feel this like that. It wouldn't be sort of like that. It would go.
She soared.
She soared, absolutely. Yeah.
Was she cold, hot, comfortable?
Comfortable, yeah.
When you were deciding, on the day that she did flip over eventually, and you were deciding what to do, just talk me through what was going through your mind when you realised that the other plane, the Norson, was not going to come, and you were heading back to Stonington, and you began to run into difficulties. Just talk me through that process, what your thinking was at the time.
Well, my thinking was, right, we've got the aircraft started up and it could have been otherwise. Mm. And set off and climbed and climbed and climbed. And then I kept noticing that although we seemed to be climbing, the movement forward wasn't anything like good enough. And I had a moment when I had to think to myself, I'm not going to get back to base going this way. The only possible way is by turning slightly to the left, and as I turn, look for a way down by the glacier. And that's what happened. It meant, I suppose... It was a little bit like flying on board ship, that you felt that you could bring your whole lifetime and your whole thoughts into you are doing this moment, and it is the moment that you're doing now that counts forever. And this is what I felt as I did on the carrier. I felt that this, I didn't think about Bernard, I didn't think about Reg, I only thought of this moment that I am flying now. No more.
So you were very aware it was a critical moment.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it didn't make me critical. In the sense, I wasn't thinking...
You weren't panicking.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking what I'd do next. I was reverting this point of reacting absolutely from my experience in the past of drawing all right to that tiny point. It was exactly the same. And writing my own story for myself and the family, it was then that I realised what I had been doing. But that's what it had been. Mm. But it wasn't a kind of conscious doing, I better do this or what. None.
Were you frightened?
Sorry?
Were you frightened?
No. No, no. It was what I was doing. It's what I had to do. Mm. They put a lump in my throat, I must admit, when I saw the glaciers, bits of this stuff that was stuck in front of me, well, and underneath me, floating, not even floating, but solid lumps behind me as I went over this. That made me heap. But then it was answering to the situation. I knew that I had to go further away where those were not. Because if I had been gone in directly into them, it would have killed the three of us. Yeah.
So you flew over a piece of ground to see if it was clear.
Yeah.
Then you went back the other way.
Yeah.
And then you flew over it again to land.
Yeah.
Now, is that something you've been trained to do, or did you work that out on the spot?
Oh, no, I hadn't been trained to do anything, but on the spot. I just knew that's what I had to do.
Something told you?
Yeah, well, you're an experienced pilot, and you come up to any situation. It tells you what your experience is the right thing to do. Mm. See, I had the same thing happen to me up in during training. When we had formed up as a group with a very experienced pilot, and I was his number two, and he took off, and I in my number two position took off close to him, and about 200 feet up, I lost the engine completely, like that. And the right-hand side were high power cables, and the Hun, they directly is the town. On the left-hand side, I would be maybe 150 feet up, not high enough up to get into the wind that was coming that way. But I just decided I couldn't go right into the power cables straight away. I couldn't go into the town. But what I could do is slide sideways into the wind as far as it would go. And it only got halfway through. And it wiped, being a swordfish, it was a fixed undercarriage. It wiped the sides off, the undercarriage off. It meant that my two passengers in the back It was good. They were going sideways, and they jumped out immediately, and the engine rolled off. And all I did to make sure that everything, I switched everything off so it wouldn't go up. And that was it. So as when you're an experienced pilot, you do what you feel immediately, and you don't work it out.
You'd had a tricky moment with Ice Cold Katie just before, hadn't you, when she did not brush her wing tip against the ground at one point?
No, it was the one that I took up onto the plateau to meet the two oncoming people coming back. When I came back to land at the top of the slope, there should have been one or two members of the group come out and hold the wings. And they didn't.
Oh, so you were on the ground already when the plane tipped?
No, I was on the ground when it, and it started to slide because it was almost glare ice at that point. It started to slide sideways. And again, I had to make a decision because the cliff was not far away. Right. So I shouted to Dave, who was with me, get on that side of the ski. And he knew what I meant straight away. And he opened the door, get up, and leant on that side so that that ski dug in at the side and gave it a burst of throttle, and that was it. Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you very much indeed. Whatever happened to the plane?
What happened to at that moment?
No, in the end.
It would go out with the ice just after, remember I said.
But it was never reclaimed?
No.
Okay.
It's the bottom of the sea somewhere in my Great Bay area. Mm-hmm.
They built a hangar for her, didn't they?
Yes.
Again, that was also an interesting experience.
It was, because the group of the people who were there the year before could tell us where the worst winds would come from and might mess up the whole of the thing, so we couldn't even get the aircraft out. But so we took his advice, and that would have been all right as it happened.
Mm-hmm. But when you were building the hangar, there was some problem with measurements.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. The wood that was supplied to build the hangar with was too short. Is that correct?
If so, I don't remember. Really. Because we made a very serviceable hangar out of it.
That was there for quite a long time, I think, was that hangar.
Yeah.
Okay.
You had a dog that tried to eat the hangar at one point.
Yeah, tell us about
that. No, I didn't know. I can't remember that one.
You got shut in the hangar overnight by mistake, apparently.
Oh, I'd forgotten that one. But the one dog one, which was, I found very interesting. Dave had a dog he was very fond of. Now, this dog was old and had the same kind of fairly. Have you met Dave at all?
Yeah.
Dave was a Yorkshireman with a kind of fairly square, big face. And this dog was quite like him. And Dave took to him and played with him and messed about him. But he was no good as a sledge dog. He was too old.
Yeah.
But Dave wanted badly that this dog should have sex with a bitch. Because he wasn't going to get it for future reasons or anything else. And he was on about this for such a long time that, in fact, they gave in to him. And there was... this dog tacked on to a bitch who wasn't wanting anything to do with it, but they, as dogs do, they were locked together. And all the other dogs who were there were roaring their heads off and going at the chains to try and get away themselves. But it was very funny, that little bit.
How did you get on with the Americans, Tommy?
Well, apart from the boss man.
Vin Romney.
Yeah, because he had all sorts of tales about how our people had messed up the abyss. And, of course, they were the ones who messed it up, messed it altogether, because they left windows open when they left it finally. They left doors open. When the snow was thick on the ground, they would take trash out and dip it on top of the snow, with the result, when summer came, they had all the trash still there and so on. So, but apart from him, the Americans were great. They did all sorts of stupid things, you know.
Such as
when the gale blew the couple up on the top, they walked down to the base with their skis over the shoulder, knowing that whole bit of area was full of crevasses, that kind of thing. And of course, that's why one of them fell down.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the rescue of that man? Is this Peterson?
Well, I was there. I volunteer, because I tend to volunteer for everything. for the experience, you know. I volunteer, but Batson was chosen because he was the smallest man that was there on the spot. And he also had done a little bit of climbing. And he was the obvious man for it. He wasn't the obvious man for me later. Shall I mention this one?
We'll come to that later as we go along.
Yeah. Well, do it now if you like.
Do it now,
yeah,
if you
like. Yeah.
Well, at one time, as you know, we didn't have anyone as a chef. We had to do our own cooking. And I was chef this particular day. And I was in the kitchen, and someone had a whole gallons of boiling water on the esse. And as he turned round, he turned it down over my feet. And all that happened to me was this terrible pain. And I fell down and curled up. And the next thing I do happened when I wakened, I was in my bunk, and the Batson was standing beside me. And he said to me, "I'm very sorry, Tommy, but you've got..." What did I say it was?
Epilepsy.
Really? And I said, "Oh, God, what does this mean?" And he said, "It means that eventually you will be one of these people who..." And he gave me the whole thing, that I would go off my head, and it would be screaming and rounding and all this kind of thing, the thing we imagine, the epilepsy. And well, that shattered me, as you can imagine. And very soon, I decided that I wasn't going home, that I had this most beautiful woman, and I asked her marriage before I'd even held her hand, and she was bright and clever, and funny and everything I would have liked to have been. And I wasn't going home to her to be one of those. She knew I was going to, at that moment, knew I was going to the Antarctic. And we had only met on maybe half a dozen occasions in a family affair. And anyway, I was getting close, and I burst out and said, told her what I felt about her. And she said, "Why did it take you so long?" Because she'd felt the same thing.
You got no choice, had you, really?
No. So, I mean, that was it. And anyway, I could not go back to this wonderful woman and be one of those horrible characters.
Epileptic.
Absolutely. Right at the far end, because this is what the doctor said with me as I was coming to, right to the far end. And I made up my mind I would go into South America somewhere and disappear. And she would be desperate. But she would eventually get over it and meet someone else. And that was it. So,
and this diagnosis was based on somebody else pouring hot water over your feet?
Yeah.
Did you not question?
Well, I couldn't question.
Why not?
Because he was a doctor. And I thought he was... I thought doctors then. And I hadn't...
Neurotic.
Yeah. Mm. And eventually it happened. When I went back to Stanley, I saw the doctor there. He said, "Tell me exactly what happened." And he said, "No possibility. No possibility. But when you get back to UK, see a specialist." And, but, I mean, I could have kissed him then, as you can imagine.
And what could you have done to Butson?
Well, the thing was that I had a chat with the governor.
Tifford?
Yeah. And I said to him, "Look, out there in Antarctica, Butson was an absolute hero. I couldn't, even if I had someone else say anything, I couldn't make him not a hero there." I said, "Back in Stanley, he was a hero then. And with everyone that was out there in America, he was a hero because he went down the crevasse.
To rescue Peterson."
Yeah. So I said, "I think it would be better if I said nothing about this and kept it to myself. And this is why I have not communicated with any of these people since then. I left Butson to be the hero that he was, which he was." And then why I broke this rule was I've got a lot of relatives in America and Canada. And people were getting in touch with me outside the family and say, "You're Tommy Thompson, we've picked you up," and this, that, and the next thing. I thought, right, I'm going to say now to anyone ask me what happened, and I will tell them that I never had epilepsy. I've never had it since, nor have I had anything like it. And that's
what... When did you decide to break your silence on that subject?
Mainly when people in America were getting really interested in Antarctica, and you know that they have been, they would find me somewhere.
Yeah.
And then they would send an email to me or whatever.
So we're talking about 10 years or so. In the last 10 years, have you?
Oh, less than that, really. Than that.
This is John Stewart, interview you on the telephone, didn't he?
Yeah.
For his history.
Yeah. Did you ever tell Butson that his diagnosis had been contradicted?
No.
He's been dead for a long time now.
Has it?
I told no one else.
I've got here a memo from Butson banning you from flying.
Mm.
Written 2 weeks after the only plane you had crashed.
Yeah. I heard this one.
Yeah.
It's a bit pointless.
It is pointless. I would never say anything now. I mean, I've been in touch with a lot of people now who were, for instance, the naval character who wrote the book.
Oh, John Myers.
Yeah.
Admiral Myers, yeah.
He said, "What did you tell Butson afterwards?" I said, "Nothing."
Yeah.
We were talking about the Americans, Tommy. I've never seen a picture of Jenny Darlington. Describe her to me.
Oh.
She was a twinkle in your eye.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. She was an absolute stunner, a complete stunner. And she had everything about her that a woman should have. Except everything Nan had, and a lot more. But she had a lovely, she smiled a lot, and her eyes always were smiling too. When you talked to her, she was earnest. She believed you, what you're saying, and so on, like that. She was that kind of person you don't meet very often. And her husband was quite different. He was tall and strong and very manly. But he was a character too. And he said all the Americans liked to visit us, especially at tea time.
Smoke all.
Yeah, because the things that we were good at that they didn't have was baking bread, scones and stuff like that. And they loved to come over. And one person came over, here it was Jenny's husband, and he casually mentioned that he could hypnotize people. Now, the person who was boss at that time was Ken Butler.
Yes.
And he was a big man as well. And he said, nobody could do this to me, because he was a senior officer in the army during the war. So they did. One evening, he came across and he got the lights to go out and a couple of candles sit and lit on the table. And Darlington just said, right, sit down everyone and keep quiet. And he said to Ken, keep the blue light, the green light, did that for a little while. And then he said to Ken, stand up. So Ken stood up. Right, sit down. Ken sat down. And then he went. And Ken said, come on then, where's all this? Where is all this going to happen then? And we all laughed and said, it has. But Ken wasn't very too happy about that. But he was under the touch of this, the candles. Yeah. But it was...
I gather Jenny had some jewellery in the Antarctica.
A lot. Which she produced at what is the most important night in the Antarctic, is, of course...
Midwinter.
And I happen to be the chef for the midwinter setup. And that was some job, because I had to bake a huge cake. We had naval rum, and I got a clean bucket and put at least, I think, a gallon of neat rum and some couple of bottles of orange juice, and then set it on the essi cooker and got it steaming hot. And most of the Americans were there, and it was a lovely time. And Jenny was there.
She came to the British Dutch.
Yeah.
Were the Americans dry? Were they dry all their days?
I don't think so. I think they were supposedly dry, but I think a few of them made...
But there wasn't that much alcohol.
No.
I can see the attraction now.
Yeah. Anyway, she looked a picture, did she, in this jewellery?
No, I don't... well, there were, but I didn't have
she
it.
She looked a picture in the jewellery.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm sure. She did, but the thing was, I was so busy doing what was needed. But, yeah, she was a beautiful person to have anywhere.
Am I right in thinking that Christmas pudding was one of your specialities?
This was out in the field.
Was it?
Out in the field, you made some homemade Christmas pudding when you meant to meet the Hope Bay party.
Oh, yes. Was that what... Yeah.
And it reacted quite harshly to the Christmas pudding to everybody.
Isn't that strange? I'd forgotten all that. I mean, I can... Yeah, I can mend it.
But that was quite a thing when you saw the plateau party from Hope Bay coming down.
Oh,
when you'd gone out to guide them in.
The thing is that we met up on the other side at a certain Nunatak.
Yeah.
And
three slice Nunatak?
Maybe. Anyway, it was a particular one. And there was the person who came. The first thing we noticed about the Hope Bay was the dogs were huge in comparison with ours. No doubt about that. I don't know why it should be, but they were huge. They could put their paws up on your shoulders. Ours were working dogs, right down, heads down, and great. And there was someone from called Mac Choice from Hope Bay. And the first thing he said to me was, "Taxi! Taxi!" And I said, why are you saying that? And he said, well, if a taxi comes, I know I really am mad.
This was a big multi-sledge party, was it, from Hope Bay down to Stonington?
Yes.
The year you were there. You went out to meet them?
Yes, we went over the top and down the other side to meet them.
Can you describe that encounter?
Well, it was my meeting, in real terms, with glaciers and the great depths that can go downward. And it was a wonderful experience because it meant that we had to get across this and therefore go across glacier country. And we therefore slipped into crevasses, and dogs would pull us out, and so on. But when you looked down, you saw it wasn't just a crack. There were little castles down there, plastic have changed, they've cracked and little bits sticking up, and then depths going down of double colours from blues to greens to white clear ice. But it was different from what you could have imagined until you fell down. You couldn't help but look at first. You had to look. And the dogs were wonderful. So that was the first thing I noticed on that trip. And the other thing I noticed, how when we were on the whole type bit itself before we went down, we always travelled by night, because in daytime, if there are, even at that time, even if there are glaciers, they'll be at their softest in daytime.
Yeah.
So you tend to travel by night, where there's plenty of sun anyway, light anyway, plenty of that. And sometimes when you would sleep a bit, but other times you would watch and you could see these great thunder roaring, belting, coming down other parts of the whole vista, and they would be, seemed to be going very, very slowly, but in fact they were going at very great speed, and they seemed to froth at the edges as they came nearer and nearer their ending. And that was a wonderful experience, and the sound was tremendous. Yeah, those were the things that stuck out on that.
Should we move to the Falklands? Do you have any more supplementaries?
Yeah, we can get on to the Falklands. Yeah.
Well, you left the Antarctic on the Bisco.
Yes.
And the ship was not alone, is that right? There were some American ships with it.
Yes, in the sense that we both got out at the same time, because there happened to be an American icebreaker not all that far away. And it was going to happen that all the American lot and our lot are going to be in for another winter.
This was the autumn of 40... This would be sort of May, April, May 48?
Yes.
Approximately.
It might have been a bit earlier than that.
Yeah.
But it was Port of Beaumont, there was a Bisco, and I don't know which icebreaker it was.
No, I can't remember.
It's on that picture, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which again, really,
yeah.
I'm not sure which icebreaker it was.
Yeah.
Was the relief smooth? An easy job? Easy...
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, obviously, I was desperate to get back to my wife.
Well, you stopped at the Falklands on the way, John, didn't you?
Oh, that was wonderful. Wonderful in a way.
That's when you got the positive diagnosis, the good diagnosis.
Yes.
But what else were you doing on the Falklands?
Well, again, Miles Clifford was very kind to me. And he said, will you come and stay at Government House? And I said, well, I can't, because I had promised that my companion on going, we shared a tent, a young consular who lived locally. He came with us as a handyman, and we shared a tent the other side. I had promised him that any time I spent in the Falklands, I would be with his parents, because they were very poor. And if they put me up, it would give them money that they wouldn't have had. So I pleased... I made this point to Miles Clifford, and he said, sure, that's fine, do just that. And then he said, I would like you to go. He told me the position about women in particular, out in the ordinary part around the Stylands. And the thing was that they had to come in to have a baby sometime before the baby was born, because the only way they could get in was on horseback. And lots of things happened during that period. So he said, I would like to get a small aircraft to do that job. And I would like you to go out to the various stations and find the possibilities.
A landing strip.
That kind of thing, yeah. And that was why I went by on horseback. And, of course, the thing that always happens is something different. The first thing that happened to me was the horses were late. And this, the one we were going to go to first was in darkness long before we got there. And I said to the guide who was taking me, but how the horses are going to know? And he said, they know without any trouble. They won't put a foot wrong. So that was something. And occasionally, I think once we swam a river with your feet up on there. another time I saw one of the peripatetic teachers and had a chat with them, the one that goes giving kids back music and everything. But I went to one place and I always stayed with the boss man. And I was sitting by a peat fire one evening, and it came the wife. And she was in a beautiful dressing gown, not dressing,
nice.
Evening dress. Oh. And she sat on the other side of the peat fire, and she chatted a bit, and then she put her hand down and pulled up a tin of pipe tobacco. And she, it was the kind of pipe tobacco that are all squiggly bits, and she took it out, and put some in her finger, and took one of those razzlers, you know, the paper, yeah, and rolled herself a cigarette and lit it. And then she handed the tin across to me. Well, being a naval type, I knew how to do this. So we sat and chatted there until her husband came down, smoking pipe tobacco in that way. So that was unusual. Another one was the son was home, and he had come from one of the schools, that very classy schools in South America.
Oh, in Montevideo, the British school in Montevideo, yeah.
And he said, oh, you want, after all day on a horse, you want to have a bath. So he took me up into this big room, and there was a bath in the centre. And he took all his clothes off and had a bath. Now, this wasn't used to this kind of thing for me, even after all the years in the Navy. So I was then obliged to take all my clothes off and get this in this bath. And that was another thing. The last thing, I had to go to Pebble Island. And Pebble Island, of course, being an island, I had to go by boat. And I went by this boat and came into the quay and got out, and there was a group of men waiting. Now, the actual place where I had to go to was about 5 miles away. So I had to take a horse. And they brought this horse along, and it was beautiful. You have never seen such a shining. It had been, oh, it was fantastic. And I thought, be honest, yes, this is your horse. So I got on, and the horses I had no trouble with because they had soft Spanish saddles. And I got up, no problem. And then they let it go. And it was going home. And it just went like the clappers. And of course, I just had only shoes on. And they were the big, gritty metal long things coming up here. And before I got to the other end, the blood was running down into my shoe. And this was their idea of a joke. And they've told me afterwards that horse had won the Governor's Cup the year before.
Stanley races.
Yeah. But anyway, these ones.
Were the landing strips ever created?
Yes, one or two were. And one or two used it in the war. Between
the Falklands War?
Yeah. And that gave me no... That made me feel horrible. But basically, every summer, every single one of them were almost the same. There was, at shearing time, or when sheep were brought into the home base, their little feet always went into the same place, year after year after. And it was no problem seeing where that was.
Yeah.
And I brought back to the governor details how long I measured it, because I took a big tape measure. I took a compass and things like that and put detail of all of them out in every place. And it was no problem.
This is part of Clifford and John Huckle's plan to be able to run the Falkland Island air service, wasn't it?
I suppose. I didn't know anything about that.
No, because it was in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think John, it was when he was flying in the Falklands, it was all float planes. But yeah, he was. Mm-hmm. Sorry, he was the forerunner with New Zealand. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you have on your...
Well, the icebreaker was the Burton Island.
Was that it?
And it was February 1948.
Yeah. To end this, if this is an appropriate moment, I don't know. But eventually I went into teaching. And apparently I was quite a good teacher. And there was a... Just after the war in the early 50s, there was that big exhibition in London.
Yes, 1951.
Yeah.
The British Empire Exhibition, wasn't it?
Was it? I can't remember
British
that.
British Empire Exhibition.
Yeah. Anyway, I was a teacher in my first school, and I had to take some kids into London from Harwich to see the bits and pieces. And sure enough, there was a bit about the Antarctic with huskies. Now, I recognised one of those huskies, and it was John Tonkin's leader dog, who was brilliant, absolutely brilliant as a leader. And it doesn't matter what it was, whether it was milk white out, white out, this dog would get on the correct course.
Name?
Sorry?
The dog's name?
Darkie. And John would go out and ruffle his ears and say, "Darkie, you old bastard." That's his exact words. Now, as soon as I saw this dog, I said, in a quiet, soft voice, the way that John did things, I would say, "Hello, Darkie, you old bastard." And he got up. I can keep it forward. An old dog by then, with his tail very slowly. And I felt horrible. I felt I'd betrayed him by making him think this was his master of a wave time ago. I better carry on with this one. Now, then I became eventually, because I was quite good as a head, I became eventually
Inspector?
Yeah, Her Majesty's Inspector of Schools. And it was near the six months before I retired, this young man joined the inspectorate, and he said to me, "Which school did you once teach in?" And I said, "Harwich." And he said, "Do you know that I was one of the kids?" Yeah. And I mean, that meant a lot to me, yeah, as you can imagine.
Because Dyke, Vivian Fuchs took over John Tonkin's dog team. So Dyke became his lead dog, and yeah, that's how he ended up back in the UK. And
at the exhibition?
Yeah, absolutely. And then he went to live with Fuchs in Cambridge.
Did you meet Fuchs?
No.
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 Well, you'd pass in the night, he'd be coming to show where you
Yeah, he wouldn't be. I mean, I wouldn't lose Fuchs. Yeah, folks, yeah,
he wasn't particularly well known then, he was just the chap who was taking over from Butler as base commander. Mm. Mm.
Looking back on your life, how important was that Antarctic episode to you? Do you think it shaped you in any way?
One knows not how one is shaped by it. I think it did in some ways. Did I put it down somewhere? Yes, it had a different thing. It happened to a different thing from what happened to me and what happened to a lot of other people. Most people who go to Antarctica come back and say, "This is the greatest thing that happened to me. I will go again. Yeah, I must go again." Yeah, yeah. No, it didn't happen to me that way. But it shaped my life in many ways.
How do you mean, for example?
Yeah. I'm trying to find a bit of wrote down. I think one thing that it did really tell me that I was a people's man. You know, people were more important than anything else to me. And therefore, that's why, although I hadn't thought it then, right at the beginning, I knew I wanted to get out into the big world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meet people in different circumstances. I thought I had written that down. No. But basically, that was it. As we went out from the Falklands, and I saw the rest of Marguerite Bay disappear in the distance, it wasn't with, like, seems to hit most people.
Right.
This is it. I mean, like Kevin Walton.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
okay. He was the kind of person who would want to explore all his life, but particularly anything to do with Antarctica.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't feel that. I felt I'm going away from this. I'm going back to where there are people. I know that I felt that.
So you missed people?
And I did. I didn't miss individuals. I mean, all the others...
Apart from
now. No, but the thing is, all the others down there at with me were all individual people, right? And I knew very great deal about them. And we had two people who were like Dougie and Reg, the surveyors.
Yeah.
They had a lovely way of looking at life. John Tonkin.
Yeah, he was a bit of a hero, was John Tonkin, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And afterwards as well.
Yes.
He was a hero in North Africa during the war.
Yeah.
And yet he had the softest, gentle voice. And he had always time for you. Kevin Walton, because he was one of these people who wanted desperately to be wanted in that... He wanted to be, but he was careless. He was the kind of person who, two thumbs together was always the thing that happened. Or he would want to get up in the middle of the night, go clonking out in his shoes, and then when he got back into his bunk, he would throw them out onto the floor. And if they hit something soft, you say, when is it going to happen? You know, so you, these all were individuals and were close to me. I felt that, close to you. And the young lad, he was wonderful.
Brilliant.
No, they, the place he kept in contact with the world,
Terry Randall.
Yeah.
Because he was a really good operator, wasn't he?
Yeah, but the thing was, he had something I'd never seen before. He was able to use his key both ways. So he got twice the speed out of it. So I was going, and a lot of people hated him at the other end because he's too quick. And Doc, he was odd. I mean, forget what he did with me. He would come up to a group talking, and suddenly one of the group would say, "Oh God, Doc. He made the most awful smells." And he would say, "Oh, sorry," and creep away. So everyone had their thing about them. And Bernard, in fact, was an absolute expert at some aspects of cooking. Absolute expert.
Yeah.
I was good at some things, but he was excellent.
He's still very fit, is Bernard.
So, did you then miss what we might call greater humanity? You miss crowds.
No.
What was it you missed when you were in the Antarctic about people? You had individuals, but you didn't have a larger population. Is that what you missed? You said you were a people. No, you discovered you were a people's person.
Yes, it's just in the sense that you always know that there are people around you are living purposeful or not purposeful life, but they're people that are doing something like living. Whereas in the Antarctic, you couldn't do that. You were working for one purpose.
Yeah.
And fine. And that purpose may stay you forever and ever. But in the big wide world, in here, I've made a lot of people. We've only been here seven years now. And a lot of people will shout to me across the street or come out and say, "Hi, Will," because that's what they call me, yeah. And some people. It's that feeling that there are people moving about. I met someone this morning, and the first thing he said to me was, he's about 78. He said, I've got to go to hospital. And he pours his heart out, tells me what's wrong. The doctor thinks he's losing blood inside his gut. And it's that kind of thing, and that's why...
So I'm trying to get to the bottom of this, Tommy. So let me just try this one then, see whether you agree with this. You found the Antarctic limiting in terms of the range of people you could communicate with.
No, it's not that thing. It's a general feeling that out there is. Can I give you one example?
Yes, please.
When I went to Malaya and I became head, very quickly I became head of a small school, which grew in size to about 200 with 8 teachers. And I became very interested in all sorts of things there, including the Aborigines. And I was taken out to an Aborigine development, but it wasn't a real Aborigine one. It was a mixture. So I asked if I could be taken into a real part of the jungle. Now, it was during the war that was going on with Britain, and the Chinese desperados were in the jungle. And therefore, there were little places in the jungle, landing strips. You asked earlier if I had flown again. Here's one. And the pilots didn't like going in there. They hated it because it was so small. Mm-hmm. And the trees were right close up to the landing strip. But I asked the right people because I knew how the army worked it. And if the army works in a certain way, and if you go to the right people at the right time. So I asked about this. And they got permission that myself and someone else could go into the deep jungle and be landed for several days. Well, this was wonderful. And the pilots hated it, but we went in. And from the landing strip, we went in, and there were the real. They were great. Of course, for the 2 or 3 minutes, their breasts were always bare. And they just... But they were nice and friendly. And so we got to know them a bit. And they asked, they indicated they wanted to have a big day, a big evening rather. And they brought in logs from everywhere, and they had a big fire. And as we went, I went, my companion, he was afraid, really. But I wandered around in the light of this. And the first thing I saw was a young woman, about 12. And there was a soft light shining, and she was combing her hair, and it was the bamboo comb. And as she combed slowly down, her breasts rose and fell. and I hurried away. I didn't want her to see me looking. And then we had the big fire happened, and they did all sorts of things that put on for us. They had something that was almost like West Indian. A young woman and a young man, very close together, but not touching, no touching. And the girl would be saying things to him, "Who was that? Saw you and behind the longhouse last night." This kind of thing, abrade him for whatever. And he would go move backwards slowly, not saying anything. And then she would stop. And he would move forward slowly. And he would abrade her. That's me. That's Nan. And it was something special. And then they would be singing, and the bamboo chompers would be going, and somebody would a single bit of wire, and play on that. And then they would have a couple of people with sharp panangs, pretending to kill each other and just miss by fractions. And so I said to my companion, "We'll pretend to do something." And we did. We rolled about in the dust and fiddled about. And that was cheered. And then the fire died down, and we went off to have various mosquito nets. They all came, patted us on the shoulder, smiling and so on. And I went under the net, and everything became quiet. And yet, I could feel the jungle falling in on us and surrounding us. That was a part of meeting people in different surroundings and different ideas, etc. That all this doesn't work in the Antarctic.
No.
Does that answer your question?
Thanks, Tommy.